Hello and welcome to this GCP short produced in partnership with London and Capital and all about onboarding and implementing a new investment strategy for your captive. Over the next 25 minutes, I'll be joined by Shadrach Kwaza, Executive Director at London and Capital, and Adele Gale, Deputy Managing Director of Robus Group in Guernsey. Shadrach and Adele discussed a typical and variety of investment appetites amongst captive owners, why fixed income products are popular and the potential drawbacks of that approach, and how to go about switching or onboarding to a new investment strategy. For more information on London and Capital, you can visit their Friend of the Podcast page on captiveintelligence.io. There are links in the episode show notes. So Adele, great to have you back onto the Global Captive Podcast. Just to start off with on this discussion, how would you assess the current investment appetite among the captive owner community, and how much does that vary?
I think there's a huge appetite at the moment to invest the captive money into proper strategies with investment managers. And the appetite for the types of investments does vary fairly broadly, but stay within the kind of liquid fixed income cash type portfolios that perhaps have been quite traditional to the captive market.
Thanks, Adele. And Shadrach, what are then some of the pushbacks you sometimes hear when you are, you know, talking to a client or a captive about maybe a change in their investment strategy?
This is an interesting question, Richard, because the discussion has evolved as the market environment has changed. So pre-COVID, the main pushback was from boards looking to sort of warehouse the assets with their parent, either by investing through the parent's treasury function or using loan backs into the parent. And from an asset liability management stance, I'd argue there are some clear issues with holding assets with the parent whilst also underwriting risk for the parent. In our experience, many parent treasury teams tend to be unfamiliar with the nuances of investing assets for insurance entities. And sometimes this results in suboptimal portfolios. And in some cases, captives holding way more risk than we would expect for an insurance entity. During and immediately following the pandemic, the challenges we got shifted to the low yields available in the market over that period, when central banks were pushing bond yields into sort of zero and negative territory. The main pushback then was whether the investment juice was worth the squeezing, which in our view was at the time. But, you know, a lot of the discussion was around, you know, yields are so low, is it worth us putting money into the market? More recently, the hurdle we've had to overcome has been the comparison of our strategies to bank deposits and things of that nature. So yields have risen significantly as central banks have sort of waged war on inflation. And this has made cash at the bank and certificates of deposits a lot more attractive. We run strategies that mirror holding cash, and we have a lot of interest in those strategies more recently. But I think our view is as economies start to see inflation easing and economies slowing, the market expects interest rates to start falling, meaning the reinvestment risk of these sort of certificate of deposit-like or cash-like strategies is high, as they're unlikely to command the same high yields that you're seeing now going forward. So you know, in different environments, we get different sort of areas of discussion. And right now it is, you know, is cash better than sort of investing in other assets in the market?
So yeah, thanks, Shadrach. I mean, fixed income products are obviously popular and attractive at the moment. You mentioned obviously the higher interest rates of the last couple of years. Are there disadvantages to that approach though?
Well, like any investment product, there are pros and cons, and the choice to invest really depends on the types of risks a captive is willing and unable to manage. So for sort of fixed income, I think the main challenges, we would probably divide the sort of main disadvantages or challenges into three things. Default risk, so the risk of losing the investment wholly or completely or partially. Volatility risk, so that's what we would call mark-to-market risk, and liquidity risk. So for captives in particular, one can say you can tackle the default risk side by investing in high-quality paper or short-dated sort of certificate of deposits or longer-dated bonds, and by avoiding as much as possible holding too many eggs in one basket. So the focus there is the quality of the investment. The volatility risk issue, I guess, it's only an issue if one expects to redeem the security before it matures, in which case, if you're redeeming it when the valuation is low or is falling or is suddenly falling below the purchase value, then you'll end up realizing a loss. So usually, the longer the time to maturity of the sort of investment asset, the higher the exposure it is to this sort of volatility or mark-to-market type risk. And the last sort of major sort of disadvantage or challenge is, and I think the one that's most relevant to captives is liquidity risk. And this is where we find captives come a cropper. Often it's been because they hold these sort of securities that are not easily liquidated in the market at a predictable price and have needed to redeem the position and found out that either they can't redeem it at all, or there's a haircut to the redemption amount. You know, this risk can be reduced by sort of investing in publicly traded securities issued by sort of larger corporates or financially robust institutions, as well as diversifying their portfolio. But I think that the sort of liquidity issue for captives tends to be the major one we come across.
Adele, is there anything you wanted to add regarding the kind of disadvantages to the fixed income approach?
I think that's absolutely it. And Shadrach's really divided that up in a kind of very neat way for us to think about. I think putting my insurance management hat on, we also have to think about the operational risk that causes for insurance managers. They obviously have reliance placed on us by captive boards to be able to model liabilities and ensure that the captive has sufficient liquidity. So for insurance managers, it does de-risk our position and perhaps puts less stress on the reporting and the accuracy of when predicting when liabilities are likely to fall due by investing in a more sophisticated cash strategy.
And Adele, what are the important themes then to captive owners and insurance managers when you speak to them, you know, when they're discussing investment management and maybe discussing and debating different options or a different strategy going forward?
So I think we can sort of divide up the captive management community into different levels of sophistication. I think there are those captive owners which are well established. They have a very clear strategy on what they're trying to achieve. And for those types of mature captives, it's really possible for them to look at the portfolio of investments that they hold and take different approaches to different sections of the capital, if you like. So that portion of the capital that's maybe held on a more long-term basis for a regulatory capital relief, portion of the capital that's held to meet claims, perhaps as they fall due within reasonable levels. And then that portion of cash that's maybe more transient, i.e. you've received in insurance premiums and you know within 90 days you have to then settle reinsurance premiums. So you know that there's a kind of a very clear timetable on when that cash is going to be due to be paid out. And for captives that have that type of very mature and very known strategy, you can look at investing the chunks of capital into different types of assets and assets that perhaps provide more security of long-term return, but have a subject to volatility in the shorter term. And riskier assets are perhaps a strategy that a lot of captive owners shy away from. But as Shadrach mentioned before, sort of the loan back to parent model does come with fairly high regulatory capital charges. So having that discussion with your board, whether they take a 40% regulatory capital charge and have a loan back to parents and a kind of investment strategy within the parent's wider treasury function, or whether you invest in a slightly riskier portfolio of assets within the captive and take the different capital charges within the captive's asset portfolio, are kind of the factors that the boards need to weigh up in deciding what the strategy should be. But certainly for less mature captives, for ones which are being used to plug immediate and urgent holes in insurance programs, you do need a strategy that allows you flexibility in your assets. And therefore, these sort of cash and cash similar type investment strategies are very attractive, where perhaps you don't know what level of claims you're likely to expect, or where you don't know what level of support you may be asked to provide at fairly short notice to assist in renewal negotiations through the year.
Thanks, Adele. And Adele touched upon it a little bit there, Shadrach, regarding kind of loan backs to pair and some of the implications of that. What is the rationale for taking a more deliberate approach to investing as opposed to leaving assets in the bank or loaning back to the parent?
That's a great question. And I would start off by saying that whatever investment decision is taken, consideration of the appropriateness to the captive must be front of mind. It may well be that for some captives, sort of a cash at bank or loan backs are appropriate for whatever reason, given sort of their risk appetite and the amount of capital they have at hand, and I guess their understanding of investment markets. For most captives, though, I would argue that a more deliberate approach makes sense, regardless of the size of the captive, because they have insurance obligations to meet, and I would argue a strong fiduciary duty to ensure that this is done in the most efficient way. In practical terms, this means understanding the profile of the obligations and the regulatory environment in which they operate, articulating their investment risk appetite, and investing in assets that allow them to meet the obligation whilst maximizing returns and minimizing employed capital and risk. This in turn minimizes the overall cost of running a captive. So I think this is where some of the rationale comes in. What I mean is, a more deliberate approach to investing should, over time, produce returns and income that offsets partially or wholly the costs of running a captive. This also means that the capital in the captive is efficiently employed, potentially placing less pressure on the parent and making the captive proposition a far more sort of holistic, attractive tool. Although there are a range of arguments, I think, for this sort of more deliberate approach than we probably have time to go over at this stage. The last point I would probably raise on this is that having a deliberate approach also allows the captive to grow and evolve far more flexibly as the investment piece is more easily adapted to the changing needs of the captive. As a captive grows or begins to underwrite new lines, for example, having a static investment approach will likely result in new risks being introduced to the risk register as assets and liability mismatches begin to emerge. In our view, certainly in my view, our deliberate approach allows the captive to review the investment policy and rebalance the investment portfolios sort of to reflect the new liability profile in a far more efficient and cost-effective manner, as opposed to, for example, maybe beginning the whole investment journey from scratch because there's been a material change, say, in the liability. So I think that sort of more flexibility that investment gives, a deliberate approach to investment gives the captive, I think that's a strong argument for sort of taking or certainly considering this approach when looking at captive assets.
Yeah, and talking about that deliberate approach, one of the big themes in investment circles, obviously for a while now, has been ESG. And we've had both of you on the podcast talking about ESG in slightly different contexts regarding captive. So I'll start with you, Shadrach, and then Adele can contribute here as well. How much, Shadrach, are you seeing ESG still kind of rise up the agenda as an important topic concerning investment strategies for captives in particular?
So, certainly speaking from an asset management perspective, ESG is an investment factor that has to be taken into account when making an investment. The materiality of the ESG impact may differ depending on sort of the captive or the investment asset or the sort of issue of investment securities that you're looking at. But the fact remains that this is a factor that has to be evaluated and understood before making an investment decision. I think I would argue that that's a given. I think ESG has become more of a point for open discussion now, as opposed to a priority for immediate action. And certainly in some of the discussions that we've been having, partly this may be because investors are beginning to understand a bit more the trade-offs that are made when taking ESG decisions, and the fact that sort of a simplistic approach, for example, just excluding certain sectors or certain providers, does not always result in the intended sort of ESG outcome. Also, there are some challenges around how one may quantify ESG risk, which has resulted in some market participants inadvertently being singled out for greenwashing or wholly pulling out of ESG engagement on the basis that it's difficult to measure success. So I'd probably say in summary that although it is still important, remains a factor that must be considered when building an investment strategy, I think asset owners in general have become a bit more wary of the term, and asset managers are certainly, I feel, less willing to put themselves out there as sort of doing ESG.
No, I do agree. And I think, you know, directors feel quite conflicted in their desire to, you know, act in the best interests of the planet and be responsible investors, but at the same time to, you know, fully undertake the fiduciary duties on them as directors. And pursuing some of the, I suppose, more purist ESG strategies or backing some of the investment managers that perhaps are stronger in their claims to have ESG portfolios and ESG funds does does lead to sort of return volatility and that lack of predictability around the medium or the short term output of these types of investments. And in fact, how green those green investments are creates a kind of a sort of, you know, a doubt around those good intentions and whether they will actually come to fruition or in fact be to the detriment of the captive. So I definitely see a wariness around ESG and a kind of desire to act with some caution when deciding those types of strategies. Certainly around kind of cash portfolios, there are some kind of fairly binary indexes and mechanisms to say whether a bank is green in inverted commas or less green. But when captives are looking at perhaps more purposeful investment strategies, investing into equities, you come across all sorts of issues like, you know, the just transition and ensuring that you're supporting change as opposed to just supporting green initiatives that don't bring the sort of dirtier aspects or the browner aspects of our economy along with us.
I guess if you're thinking about ESG from a captive owners or captive insurance perspective, one of the things that, you know, we've consistently said, I think, is that we certainly feel that ESG needs to be adapted to the captive rather than, you know, taking a sort of generic approach or, you know, assuming the approach taken by an asset manager. I think it's really important for captives to sort of understand the ESG risks they are exposed to, try as much as possible to quantify that in some sense and reflect that in their underwriting as well as their investment portfolio. That's something I think that is key to having positive ESG outcomes in the long run for the captives and I think for society in general, really.
Yeah, thanks both. Really interesting to hear how that kind of is developing in the captive world, because we have talked about it quite a bit over the last few years. Adele, more broadly, when does the conversation come up with clients regarding re-examining the investment strategy and if it is optimal or needs to be reviewed? I'm just interested to know kind of when that comes up in the captive manager, captive owner conversation.
I think in a rate increasing environment, it should be discussed, you know, regularly. And I'm sure every captive owner has been through the process of having that discussion, certainly over the last 6 months. Annually, it is a requirement of the Guernsey Corporate Governance Code for every captive to look at its investment strategy and consider whether it is appropriate or whether it does need some amendment. So, you know, it should be something that's regularly being discussed, and it should be something that's discussed at least annually. I think the challenge is to introduce potential other ideas for the captive. So looking at the parent strategy, looking at the captive's own strategic objectives, looking at how much certainty there is around predicting cash flows, and the captive manager actually taking the initiative to consider whether there are other parties that should be introduced into the board meeting or brought perhaps to meet the client when they're over in Guernsey to talk about some of the options that are available, because the art of the possible is only really understood when you start to explore what is what are the products that are out there and what's available.
Shadrach, so let's say that you kind of are engaged with a client who is wanting to undertake a review of the investment strategy. How does it work? What's kind of the first and next steps?
Firstly, I'd just like to echo what Adele said in terms of this frequency of reviewing the strategy. So, you know, we would recommend that, you know, strategy review is done at least once a year, maybe more regularly than that, depending on the sort of complexity of the investment strategy. But yeah, it's really important that this is done, scheduled in and done on a regular basis, really. So in terms of actually doing an investment strategy review, we like to go back to basics and try to understand what the objectives of our captive clients are, not limiting ourselves necessarily to the investment matters where this is appropriate. This means having discussions with boards, insurance managers, risk managers, actuaries, and any other sort of key stakeholders. What we're trying to do here is articulate the objectives of the captive and any clear business plans and translate these into an investment risk appetite. So the key here, the holy grail, is like, can we pull out an articulated clear investment risk appetite for our captive client? And this then acts as a guide that allows us to understand whether the current investment strategy is still appropriate for the captive and what needs to change and how risk and return is best measured. We then usually employ our sort of proprietary strategic asset allocation engine, which helps us identify the asset classes that fit the articulated risk appetite and objectives and appropriate allocations for these asset classes. We stress test these assumptions to provide a to provide us a view on how our central investment strategy might behave in terms of market stress. Usually we follow this up with a presentation and discussion with the investment decision makers at the captive to communicate our findings and provide a view on appropriateness of our proposal. And then following that, it's usually implementation, if there are any changes that are needed. So usually our strategies should be set up so that they weather, you know, you tend to set up a strategy so that it's almost agnostic of the economic cycle, you know, a long-term strategy that should provide sort of returns and appropriate risk over the sort of economic cycle. So following a strategy review, usually there's not really much that needs to change, but you know, if there's been any material changes to the underwriting or the risk appetite or the level of capital or markets or the view in markets, you know, you may then make some tweaks to the strategy following the investment strategy review. But in general, that's how we would tackle it.
And Adele, from the insurance managers and captive managers perspective, what is the process like of onboarding or switching to a new investment strategy for the captive? Is it quite a straightforward process?
I think it depends who the captive has partnered with to date. So the onboarding process, and we actually have a client that recently selected London and Capital to take forward its new investment strategy. So that involved appointing a new investment manager and London Capital, in this case, getting comfortable with our client, with the owners of our client, doing all the account opening, money laundering checks, all of those sort of standard requirements which you expect. And so that process can be a little bit lengthier than perhaps just changing investment strategy where you already have an investment manager such as London and Capital in place. So, you know, I would say, no, it's not very onerous to pursue a different investment strategy. And it should be something that is regularly discussed and that the captive board, you know, does regularly change its investment strategy. But where you're talking about appointing new advisors or new investment managers, there can be a little bit of setup time, and then also a little bit of time to bed in, you know, online access to the portal so that you can download the reports that you need for the regulatory solvency calculations, for the management accounting and management information. And that does take a little bit of time to get used to. But, you know, if you appoint an investment manager that has really good quality, that understands the Guernsey regime and has really good quality reporting, then those things are really tick boxes. And you can really focus on following the best investment strategy and looking at the profiles. And as Shadrach sort of mentioned, going through all of those different appetite statements and different sort of liquidity models and analysis of when you think claims are going to come through so that you can match the strategy to the objectives of the captive. So yeah, so it can be very simple. It can be a bit more onerous, but overall, I think once you've appointed an investment manager and moved forward with them, the future strategy changes do become a lot easier than perhaps you would have if you had merely a fixed income sort of portfolio of fixed deposits with a UK retail bank, which perhaps is the, you know, the go-to investment strategy for captives who perhaps haven't had that that more detailed analysis of what's available in the market.
Sales obviously produce a slightly different scenario when we talk about investment management, and they've become particularly popular in the last few years with the pre-authorization scheme, which was introduced in Guernsey. So how does the investment management strategy, but also the process, change when we're talking about sell companies?
The strategy when we're talking about sell companies shouldn't change at all. Each sell owner needs to look at the appropriate investment strategy for their sell. But the process and the governance around that investment strategy is, of course, completely different when you're looking at a PCC. So a protected sell company has one board of directors with multiple different captive owners, I suppose, investing into individual sells. And so although the captive owner clearly has a role to play in setting the investment strategy for the sell, and the insurance manager clearly has a role to play in performing the, you know, the various reporting necessary to articulate the company's liquidity position and future cash flow obligations, it is the board of directors of the PCC that actually set the investment strategy. And some PCCs will go down the route of having an umbrella investment strategy, which different cells can then fit into. Some will appoint an investment manager, for instance, like London and Capital, that provides services to a number of cells. Some go down the route of each cell, you know, appointing their own investment manager or banking partner. And it really depends on the size of the cells involved and the flexibility that those cell owners want in determining the appropriate investment strategy for them.
And Chadrack, how about you guys? I know we did an episode with London Capital 18 months ago on this very topic. So if you could briefly just tell us a bit about how you see kind of the process being different for cell companies.
Yeah, for cell companies, I think for us the key thing is being able to deliver scale and an investment strategy that can be implemented for cells of all sizes while simultaneously sort of respecting the individuality and autonomy of each of the cells from a governance and reporting perspective. I guess the main difference we would see between managing assets for cells compared to, say, you know, a single captive is how the sort of risk appetite translates into actionable investment strategy. For example, when you deal with a single parent that owns a range of cells, each with their own underwriting, the risk appetite is usually the same across the cells in our experience, but may be executed in slightly different ways, reflecting the different underwriting. And this is sort of similar to what you do for a non-cell captive. Alternatively, where you're dealing with multiple loans, owners, each with their own cell and the individual risk appetite, you have the challenge of reflecting the different risk appetites whilst maintaining the sort of economies of scale to make managing each cell financially viable. I think in the latter case, experience in managing cells, having access to a range of investment ideas, a scalable investment and trading execution platform, as well as a reporting process that can be segregated is extremely important. And having all these sort of set up to manage very small and very large portfolios at the same time is not always easy. And I think this is where we feel we were able to sort of deliver something to the captive market in terms of managing those cells in a really, really efficient and cost-effective way.